The Sunstone Theological Society presents The Invisible Woman Under Patriarchy, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
She has published one book, and she has another one on the way. And despite her passion for historical research, her husband tells me she's quite a romantic, and he should know, I guess. She is, as she puts it, a co-parent of five children with a helpmeet of 18, maybe 19 years, and some of you may identify with that. When I asked her husband, well, tell me just two things about her that just kind of strike you right away, and he goes, well, she's very concerned about women's issues, and she likes to milk goats. So Paul is here under duress. His wife is expecting any minute, but she is here to support him. He was hoping she would go into labor last night, but fortunately she did not. They have two children and a cat named Ralph, and his children help him roof and do all sorts of wonderful things at the ages of 6 and 8. Okay. He says his wife is not invisible under patriarchy. I asked him that. I have to put this in just because this is really wonderful. It reminds me a little bit of my years at college. He was at BYU under Wilkinson near the end of his reign and was very active in the anti-war activities. He was there with Peggy Fletcher. And they did a write-in for student body president and won, which I'm sure at the time would have been very interesting to observe. Each speaker, Bettina will speak for 30 minutes, and Paul will speak for 20, and then hopefully we'll have time for questions. And if they go over, I will pull on his or her skirt or pants. And so at the end, we'll have questions, hopefully. Thank you.
The Relief Society in me says that you should have a handout. So my sister, Judy Curtis, has prepared and compiled a handout, a bibliography on Mormon women and the priesthood. And there's some excellent books there if you are interested in delving more into the subject. And I'd like to thank her for that. I'd also like to thank my husband for his support and input on this paper. And I'm not an invisible woman under patriarchy either. I'm a Mormon feminist and a romance novelist. And I'll not take time to explain the incongruency of these character flaws. My conversion to feminism was only a baptism of fire for my husband. This paper, at best, is exploratory of the conversion and, worse, cathartic. Most women will usually try the water gently with the toe, but having my origins in romance writing, I've chosen to jump in with total abandonment. The study of Scripture is literally the study of man. It is the study of patriarchy, of power over, of revelations and martyrdoms of prophets, and of lineages of God's chosen men. Female invisibility under Mormon patriarchy is the natural result of scriptural and historical legacy of male dominance. Today, many Mormon women are questioning their role under patriarchy. Others are actively seeking alternatives in finding dignity and value in womanhood outside the church. In the true spirit of the gospel of Jesus Christ, it is time to dissolve patriarchal barriers so that male and female might walk side by side. The roots of patriarchy begin in antiquity, and just as there are degrees of heaven, there are degrees of patriarchy, which cross the spectrum from the male supremacist to male superior to male dominant to our own LDS version, I would term male benevolent. Most include institutions or customs that favor or emphasize the male, reckoning of descent, post-marriage residence, marriage forms, occupations, social roles, and the monopoly of men of religious and magic functions. Within the church's benevolent system of patriarchy, male dominance takes the form of presiding priesthood authority, the God-given power and moral right by males only to act in God's name and direct his kingdom on earth. This places woman on the bottom rung of the ladder, God, man, woman. The church preserves these role definitions of men and women, asserted to be God-ordained, through correlated policies and programs. Commonly, women become truly negligible in our religious traditions, for in practice, patriarchy diminishes women. A spiritual order where men are ordained and women are set apart. Men serve in quorums and women serve in auxiliaries. Men lead, women follow. On the surface, the male appears inherently superior to the female. The church normally responds with a separate but equal rationale where men have priesthood and women have motherhood. But isn't this equating a biological function to a bestowed privilege? In truth, males are not dominant by nature, or they would always be dominant in the way females always have babies. In one sense, patriarchy is an attempt to make male dominance a natural fact. Likewise, there is credible evidence that male dominance over women is the product of historical and development and is not natural or biological and hence unchangeable. We might look closer at the origins of patriarchy to find why traditionally women have always been invisible on the lower strata. In her pivotal book, Beyond Power, Marilyn French submits that because of the age-old association of women with nature, the human race itself was stratified, with men taking the role of God, the human in control, and women taking the role of nature, the human who is controlled. This process comprises the origin of patriarchy. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, patriarchy's transcendence of man over woman is sorely evident in the recorded beginnings. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam. And he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from man made woman and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." Because she was taken out of man. Though it is unnatural for man to physically birth woman, it apparently became necessary to reverse or at least suspend nature's laws in order to establish the precedence of patriarchy. The Eden story in Genesis proves to be the basis for the initial stratification of women in the Judeo-Christian tradition, even though this was not reinforced directly in the teachings of the Savior. Paul doesn't hesitate to elaborate. Man is in the image of God and glory of God, but woman is in the glory of man. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. So, if through priesthood power God could create everything without the female principle, the ultimate bypass, then, like Thomas Aquinas asked, we might wonder why on earth did the gods bother to create women at all. The psalmist might have said, "What is woman that thou art mindful of her? For thou hast made her a little lower than the patriarchs." Glancing at recorded history, biblical or otherwise, we find that women suffer a low profile from Eve on. The price of visibility was high, particularly during the witch burnings of the 12th through 18th century, a time when social fears were projected on atypical women who did not fit the increasingly constricted role of a woman's place. In traditional and scriptural history, women's notoriety comes in what I call the Elmer Gantry School of Women's Studies, or more recently, Fatal Attractions 101. That all women are daughters of Eve, the temptress, and hence they are more subject to the wiles of the devil than men. This is because they are more impressionable, credulous, feebler in mind and body, and more carnal. That's for the romance writers. Their intellect is of a different nature from men's. They have slippery tongues and can't keep silent. They were formed from a bent rib and so are defective and ever deceiving. Today, women fare only slightly better in church ritual and doctrine. A friend of mine recently admitted that her missionary son met her in the temple 4 years after receiving his endowments and said, "So it's all Eve's fault." Well, certainly that isn't the point of the temple ceremony, but the institutionalization by ritual of Eve's disobedience casts a shadow upon all daughters of Eve, and in schooled and unschooled minds, contributes to the justification of man's dominance. We are told that man is not held accountable for Adam's sin, but yet, as yet, no one has vindicated Eve. Today, as well as in the past, men's and women's roles remain carefully defined by church policy and programs. Witzo devotes nearly 10 pages to the woman's role in his priesthood and church government. He justly questions, "Why should God give his sons a power that is denied his daughters? Surely a just God can have no favorites." But even Witzo will not challenge institutionalized tradition, falling into the theological practice of justifying male and female role distinctions. He writes, "This division of responsibility is for a wise and noble purpose. The gift and responsibility of motherhood make it desirable that women should be freed from the obligations of active service in the priesthood. A fair and wise adjustment has been made by the Lord so that women may have the freedom from unnecessary church responsibility in order to magnify their greater callings as mothers." My sister made the comment when I read this to her, when it said from unnecessary church responsibilities, then she said, "Does that mean the men's responsibility is unnecessary too?" More recently, a family relations manual states, "The role of a woman is to be a helpmeet to her husband, to counsel him to good works, to pray for him, to do all in her power to help him fulfill his calling as a patriarch, and to sustain him by supporting decisions as he attempts to lead her in righteousness." Even the authors of this quote seem to have a twinge of conscience, for in the next paragraph they try to justify the inequity by adding, "At times women may feel that she does not have the opportunity to be fully a person in her own right. It is important that she remember her role in the eternal framework of God's plan. She must remember that mortality is just minutes into eternity and is where the foundation is laid for eternity." Well, if this life with its system of benevolent patriarchy is the foundation of eternity, what do women have to look forward to? Will role distinctions be any different? Will men continue making all the decisions, which in this life has meant higher budgets for armaments than for social welfare? Or will women suddenly be seen and treated as equals? My recurring nightmare of the hereafter is that women are closeted in some celestial birthing chamber producing a million spirits a second to send off to heavenly wars where second-born sons rebel and bid power play after power play, battle after battle, in what seems to be the epic motif of existence, Sunday at the Armageddon Bowl. More seriously, I only believe this motif is to be true as far as it is translated correctly. In scripturally, we are working from a distorted database. We know that humanity consists of two halves, women and men. We know that, we know that humanity consists of two halves, men and women, yet in virtually all doctrinal and scriptural accounts, the main protagonists, players, and scorekeepers are male. The problem is not men as a sex. All of you take a deep sigh of relief. The root of the problem lies in a male benevolent system which builds a layered structure and then institutionalizes it by proclaiming priesthood authority as the highest good. Despite individual worthiness, this power is then withheld from a majority of membership, and privileges are bestowed according to an individual's gender. By stratifying society by lineage and gender, a patriarchal system maintains its control. Indeed, the historical constant of patriarchy is women are always on the bottom of the strata. An example of this is the 19th century issue of women receiving the vote. The passage of the 14th Amendment gave black men the vote, but not women, because they were not considered to be citizens. Women had to crusade until 1920 before the vote was extended to them nationwide. With the issue of lineage once again resolved, the landmark 1978 revelation gave black men the priesthood, but not women. It seems women are first to be served, first to serve, but last to be served. But looking on the brighter side, patriarchy as a mindset does not have absolute control in the church. Fortunately, someone comes along like Spencer W. Kimball, a free agent, a prophet's prophet, who questions tradition. The scriptures say it is written, but our belief in continuing revelation tells us it can be rewritten. Adhering to an intrinsic code of male supremacy, however, throws the church into a great paradox concerning women. On the one hand, the church says that the woman's place is to walk beside the man, not in front of him or behind him. In the face of stated equality, why then are women in fact stratified beneath men? Like the cloaking purdah of Muslim women, Mormon women are kept invisible by purdah of the mind. We cannot doubt the sincerity of our leaders when they speak out against male supremacist groups like the Aryan Nation. Unfortunately, however, the discriminating nature of the church's patriarchal structure becomes an attractant to such ideologies, not unlike Mormons' attractiveness to racist South Africans before blacks received the priesthood. Though we know that there should be no stratification in Zion, for Zion is of one heart and one mind, the church continues to place women below men through condescension, placation, doctrinal tradition, and priesthood exclusion. By ordaining men and setting women apart, patriarchy carries a high price because it divides rather than unites. It separates men and women, the family and the church. An enlightened age when men and women actively strive to find common ground, Mormon women from girlhood on are indoctrinated as to their secondary role in the church. If for no other reason, then this is the true order of things. Women become auxiliaries to men. They are conditioned to support male, not female, status. Generations of women sit by proudly, yet passively, as their 12-year-old sons and grandsons are ordained to the priesthood. But this exclusive act of ordination must send subliminal messages of inequity to women of the church, a message no amount of rationalization in sermons and lesson manuals can dispel. In the brotherhood of priesthood, men bond to one another rather than to helpmeets. This bond among men supersedes the bond between men and women as the church divides into auxiliaries and priesthood quorums. Many meetings become all women or all men as if Christ had a separate message. In councils of the church, this exclusion leaves the General Relief Society president, representing over half the membership of the church, reporting through a committee of the 70s. Why not report directly to the first presidency? In church directives regarding women's auxiliaries, the addressee is always, "Dear brethren." And women's auxiliaries must wait until these messages filter down through proper priesthood channels, if they ever do. At the administrative level, women have no decision-making voice in the church, from the design of the meeting house kitchens to church-wide programs, because everything falls under priesthood administration. Women cannot remarry in the temple without a temple divorce, but men can. The current system leaves widowed and single women leaning on someone else's priesthood or stranded on the path to exaltation. In blessings and confirmation circles, the determinant for participation becomes not priesthood, not membership, but maleness. The point to recognize is that in most ordinances of LDS religious life, women sit as silent watchers on the sidelines, never to act, only to act be acted upon. Married women are told they share in the priesthood blessings, but outside the temple they are not allowed to stand within its holy circles, to bless, to administer, to baptize, or to confirm by laying on of hands on head. Because LDS women as a whole seem to accept this and say nothing, except for myself, should we think that their own self-definition is not touched by this blatant ostracism? Under patriarchy, males also pay a price. They wear the mantle of patriarchy from birth and often carry a burden of chronic inadequacy and harbor feelings of unworthiness because they have no desire to preside over or control anyone. A man who does not magnify his priesthood calling as family patriarch often becomes the target of resentment by an overzealous wife who is conditioned to believe that she and her children are dependent on him for their celestial glory. Yet patriarchy makes control over women essential to the male self-definition. As Cleon Skousen declared in a 1982 interview, the reason we have priesthood only for men is the division of labor that exists to make men equal with women. Men need to have this leadership capability in order to balance their existing inequity with women who have historically determined the development of society because of their influence over the children. Brother Skousen's comment points out the mixed messages that women continually receive about the purpose of the priesthood. They are taught that it is the authority and power to act in God's name, the greatest gift of God to man besides the atonement itself. At the same time, women are told that priesthood is in essence a sop thrown to men because women are innately superior to men spiritually and have the capacity to reproduce the species, and so men need something to maintain the balance. This specious argument is in justification of male and female roles inside and out of the priesthood continues, peaking in talks delivered at annual Mother's and Father's Day programs. Women in the church, though silent as a group, have not been paralyzed as individuals. Today, the prevalent tried and true belief systems concerning making women negligible in doctrine and tradition, the church is paying a price. Many women are seeking personal and spiritual fulfillment elsewhere. Mormon women are looking to the self-empowerment of the New Age movement, to the resurgence of Wiccan, to the spiritual reconnection to the nature goddess identity. This search has not gone unnoticed by our leaders. Our own Patricia Holland recently declared, "Surely there has not been another time in history when women have questioned their self-worth as harshly and critically as in the second half of the 20th century. Many women are searching almost frantically as never before for a sense of personal purpose and meaning, and many LDS women are searching too, for eternal insight and meaning to their femaleness." Until recently, women seemed resigned to their invisibility, allowing men to be the intermediaries between themselves and God. But it seems evident from the rising consciousness among women, formalized in the Worldwide Conference in Nairobi in 1985, that women are no longer content to remain dependent on men to shape womankind's future. Women finding their path blocked by the fraternity of patriarchy are seeking alternatives to corporeal and spiritual awakening. This search by Mormon women manifests itself in more women participating in metaphysics and spiritualism, women's retreats and conferences, and sometimes even eventual embracement of other belief systems outside the umbrella of presiding priesthood authority. We see that the women's movement of the 80s is not based on women becoming like men, but women searching for dignity and value in womanhood. For many, this search will make them take them circling beyond the masculine value system of patriarchy to a place where the feminine value system of felicity, emotions, and nurturing are foremost. Like the nursery rhyme where Peter, pumpkin eater, had a wife and couldn't keep her, put her in a pumpkin shell, and there he kept her very well, the church has traditionally kept women in pumpkin shells and prayed they would behave. And they did, until Sonia Johnson, the boogie woman of Mormondom. Since then, we good sisters are still feeling the reverberations of Ms. Johnson speaking out. Our Relief Society lessons are often peppered with underlined "be quiet" messages. Counsel from President Hinckley in the 1988 manual counsels us, "To you wives who are constantly complaining and see only the dark side of life and feel that you are unloved and unwanted, look into your hearts and minds. If there is something wrong, turn about. Put a smile on your face. Make yourselves attractive. Brighten your outlook. You deny yourselves happiness and court misery if you constantly complain and do nothing to rectify your own faults. Rise above the shrill clamor over rights and prerogatives and walk in the quiet, dignity of the daughter of God. Truly, the male-oriented, male-administered church does not understand women and never has. Sad part is that while women are acknowledged to fulfill a different and decidedly female role, priesthood leaders apparently feel no need to understand women from a female context. As Sonia so aptly questions in her book, From Housewife to Heretic, how many bishops have ever read a book on women's issues? Notwithstanding the few revolutionaries in patriarchy's history, Jesus Christ for one, male-dominant values have been with us for so long that it's hard for us to imagine a fairer system, much less that our future salvation may hinge on something connected to women and femininity. Indeed, we are all one in Jesus, but patriarchy would have us believe that one is male. As a Mormon fundamentalist commented during the last Sunstone Symposium in a question and answer series session, when asked, where do women fit in the theology of Godhead? He said, maybe they'll be reprocessed as males. Are the heavens womanless? But for a brief mention of a mother in heaven by Eliza R. Snow in the song called Oh My Father, we have few references to feminine goddesses. In the spiritual creation, there is a mention of a female goddess model. So the gods went down to organize man in their own image, in the image of the gods to form they him, male and female, to form they them. If there are legitimate goddesses, they haven't made it to earth past the patriarchal stratosphere. As an accepted rule, God only speaks his policies through his priesthood holders. Unless I'm mistaken, God's viewpoint shifts to those men. Is there any other viewpoint? Is male dominance the only alternative? Perhaps Carolyn Pearson's personal realization in Goodbye, I Love You is the darkest apocalyptic vision of all. My God preferred men, my church preferred men, and now my husband preferred men. Certainly it is time for the church to mend the age-old breach between men and women. We should begin by acknowledging the problem, by taking notice of the overwhelming feelings of powerlessness within the ranks of its women, which manifests itself in an epidemic depression among Mormon women, high inactivity rates among young women, often marginal attendance at Release Society meetings, and an inability of many sisters to relate to the weekly lessons which have their foundations in the Patty Perfect syndrome. Divorce and family breakups will continue to occur as women, unable to cope with the far right of patriarchy, leave husbands, some even to jettison to the far left of feminism. As we cross into the 21st century, will our leaders begin to dissolve the narrow bounds of patriarchy and widen the avenue of opportunity so that male and female might walk side by side in felicity? Hopefully, President Benson's remarks in the 1985 Ensign are a view to this horizon. He tells us, the order of the priesthood spoken of in the scriptures is sometimes referred to as the patriarchal order because it came down from father to son. But this order is otherwise described in modern revelation as an order of family government, where a man and woman enter into a covenant with God, just as Adam and Eve, to be sealed for eternity, to have posterity, and to do the will and work of God throughout their mortality. When our children obey the Lord and go to the temple to receive their blessings and enter into the marriage covenant, they enter into the same order of priesthood that God instituted in the very beginning with Father Adam. Seems to substantiate the belief of some church scholars that the temple endowment is indeed an initiation of women, as well as men, into the fullness of the priesthood as restored by Elijah. The ordinance work in the temple does not appear to be essentially the ordinance work in the temple does appear to be essentially the same for both sexes. When women go to the temple, the garment of the holy priesthood is placed upon them just as it is upon men. Women are endowed or given the gift of power in the priesthood. They take the oaths and make the covenants just as men do. But when they leave, they are instructed they not only cannot function in the priesthood, but that they do not hold it either. They are essentially disfellowshipped every time they walk out of the temple and return to the world where they must function within the church, having the responsibility but never the authority to act. However, Women's entitlement to be officially ordained to the priesthood remains a matter of speculation, and Linda Newell has stated that in all her research, she has found no evidence that a woman was ever ordained to the priesthood. Certainly, ordination would help women gain visibility, but through an understanding of the nature of patriarchy, we know that much more than priesthood ordination is at stake. Whether Deborah was a prophetess and judge in Israel without ordination, or whether there was a female apostle named Junia, will continue to be challenged outright by biblical scholars and laymen alike until society's stratification of women beneath men is dissolved. This is a case where the possible must precede the factual. In the meantime, women in the church will still be trained for private virtue and men for public priesthood power. This division among the sexes has been responsible for much irrational thinking. Members in one realm are required to close their eyes to what the other realm is doing. To disconnect virtue from power, unfortunately, is to ensure that virtue will be powerless and licenses power to be without virtue. Priesthood power, withheld because of gender, becomes the power to have, to hold, and to control. Power bestowed according to worthiness is the power to influence, to persuade, and a manifestation of God's love. So what are we to do? How can we reconnect virtue with power? How are we to lift the veiling purdah of invisibility from Mormon women? Will the baby step method of minor placation suffice? Has allowing women to pray in sacrament meeting given them enough visibility to solve the problem? Or should our leaders take what I would call the Neil Armstrong One Giant Leap for Mankind approach and officially ordain women to the priesthood, risking this apostasy of large segments of Mormon culture worldwide? It seems President Benson's controversial parents' fireside talk a few years ago is a symptom of this growing perplexity. Do his strict male-female role definitions become a patriarchal backlash directed not only to women, but to the New Age male, those men who would share with wives in breadwinning, household tasks, child nurturing duties, as well as priesthood power? Men who are backsliders from patriarchy to partnership, and who are not emasculated at the thought that priesthood is not inherently male. Men who have reconnected themselves with nature and no longer feel the need to subjugate her. We find them at peace rallies, supporting environmental issues, participating in the birthing experience, tending babies at shopping malls, and even teaching church nurseries. These are men who have turned their swords into plowshares, who seek power too, as opposed to the old patriarchal standard of power over. These are the true practitioners of what our gospel teaches and what our leaders preach from the pulpit, despite its inconsistency with the underlying patriarchal system. Here again, the patriarchal nature of the church faces a paradox, the incongruency of a dominator system with the egalitarian principles of the gospel of Jesus Christ. For nothing in Christ's teachings or life supports the principle of patriarchy, power over. Our prophets plea for women to stay at home because to their minds all the ills of society have their roots in the absence of mother in the home. But have we misinterpreted what home is and who belongs there? It seems that home to some is a woman's niche in patriarchy strata. Certainly home isn't out of the workforce, nor is home a physical structure for women only. Home is the heart of well-being, the feminine value system, the core of Christ-like love. It is the familial circle of man and woman, the great round where hands linking together unite in harmony, rather than the vertical lines of a corporate pyramid where, as gods or heads of households, men preside from the top. How to more quickly usher into the beautiful, bright millennial day than for woman and mankind to call to our patriarchs to come home. Come home to partnership. Allow virtue to temper power. Recognize your origins and bonds with the Heavenly Mother. Invite her into your prayers and theology. Invite her daughters into your blessing circles and holy of holies, that man and woman might at last be equally yoked, equally endowed and equally ordained. Thank you.
There's a little sign here they brought up just before this started that says, "Attention speakers, your session is being recorded." It reminds me of a gospel doctrine class I taught a couple of years ago. And I was home teaching at that time a woman who was bedridden, and she would have been in the class otherwise. And I thought it'd be nice to record on a camcorder, record some of the lessons and have the class there so that she could kind of feel the community of people and not feel like she was missing out on everything. So I set this camcorder up and had it aimed out at the audience. And when they came in, I thought I had to explain it to them. So I said, there's a new church policy. All lessons are being recorded so that the church might know what you're saying comes the day of judgment. Amazingly, there was a hushed silence. It was paranoia. Ran very deep. I have that feeling here. I feel like I should bear my testimony to start my comment so that I might be recorded along with what I have to say. It's no news that that women don't have the priesthood in the church. I personally don't have any objection to that. However, I have to say, in the conclusion of her talk, she invited us to invite them. And actually, and I say this honestly, I don't know that that's our prerogative. I don't know that we've been given that as a function of priesthood to invite someone. I won't say anything more than that. Lynn Whiteside already has told me I've been thrown to the lions in this talk, and but I feel that basically, this paper is kind of a shotgun approach. There's a lot of things that she throws out, and I don't think I can even begin to address each point. So what I thought I would do would be to address something that I felt. I didn't feel so much this morning because you're such a pleasant person. I've never met her before. But when I read the paper, what I sensed more than anything else was anger. And I didn't feel that this morning in the way she read the paper. But when you read it on the page, you sense this kind of deep-seated anger that comes across. And I thought I might just simply... resentment leading to anger. Okay. I will not be beaten on this. but I thought I might address that. And that anger, which she feels personally, and I think a lot of women feel in some degree or other in the church. And it's the kind of anger, she mentions President Benson's talk. It's the anger that talk elicited in women at the time. More specifically, that I'd like to address for a moment. I'd like to start just briefly with an image once I got in reading a book, and it was about the Hopi people, very religious people. But among the Hopi women, the property comes down through the women's side of the family. The women essentially control the property of the Hopi people. The men have most of the ceremonial rights, most of them. Women do have some. But the women control the property, and a divorce proceeding among the Hopi consisted primarily of the women taking the men's belongings, his clothes primarily, and setting them outside the door. And he was divorced. He was not only divorced from her, but he was divorced from the land that he worked and had to go back to his mother's people. What struck me about that was the kind of interesting balance that gave to their culture. The men on the one side doing the primary propitiating type of act, women controlling the basic structure, physical structure of things. And I thought what kind of definition that probably gave to women inside the family structure, the idea that the land was theirs. I liked that image, and I thought it came to my mind when I read her paper. Our own history of the home in Western culture, it seems to me, has undergone over the last 100 years or so some very drastic changes. 100 years, 150 years ago, most Americans, I'm going to limit this to America, but most Americans were small farmers. And those who were not, another large group were comprised, or not very large, but another group were comprised of small shop owners, that type of thing, in which the shop was actually an appendage of the home, part of the home situation. At that time, just from the proximity of things, the home was a far more vital thing. Just because the farm surrounded the home was part of the farm part of the home. Just by the nature of that relationship, the woman had more power to influence what was, for those people, the most vital unit. It was an immediate unit. And she could use the force of her own personality and whatnot to have major impact on anything that went on there. That has begun to disappear, or hasn't, to a large extent, disappeared in this country. Technology brought changes, and the changes brought a new organization of labor in this country, and it was an organization of labor that took men out of, took them away every day to where the man was no longer close by. It not only did that, but it created a whole new sphere of influence, the company, or the corporation, as I began to call it. And I'll use that term here just for convenience, because I don't have much time. But the man now went to another place far away from the home, which rivaled the home in importance because it was the source of income, the source of existence for that home. They actually, in some cases and to a great extent, actually surpassed the home in importance as families began to follow the corporation around the country. Men were transferred, people went places, were uprooted so that they could keep their work. They have increased in power at the expense of the home. Also, corporations, and this is a big leap, but corporations have, over the last years, created divisions within what was left of the home by picking out children as a market, a separate market from the family unit, and addressing them directly, and therefore driving a wedge between the family, the parents, the mother, especially, and the children. The outcome of this has been to leave the home basically a place that's been sapped of all its vitality. The vitality that might have been known 100 years ago is basically gone. The husband is gone, and in many ways the children are gone. And I think, you know, the natural outcome of this now is the women are jettisoning from the home, beginning to leave a place that no longer really has any definition for who they are. You know, when I go back to that sense of the Hopi, that image of the Hopi, and I juxtapose it to what we now consider to be the home, the woman is in an empty place. There's no definition there for her. There's no sense, there's no place for her to feel any sense of power anymore, any ability to influence. And so she becomes invisible. It's my feeling that corporations are the real enemy of the family. They provide no place to define oneself. It has sucked the power out of it, and so anyone using it to know themselves must inevitably feel powerlessness. For what it does to the family and what it wants for itself, namely maximum profits, the corporation is the epitome of worldliness. And we might say the epitome of worldliness is defined by the Book of Mormon. There is a renewed emphasis on family in the culture, partly out of an intuition that we are about to lose something essential to our well-being and existence. I've read some things about this, and corporations have tried to come back and say we are family-oriented, and yet they cannot resist the temptation to lure children and other members of the family into things that are self-defeating for families. From products to pleasures to what they run across the television. They cannot resist that temptation. And so enters the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints into the late 20th century corporate world. We are taught that the family is the key unit in the church. But what identity is the church increasingly taking on? Have you ever seen the business letterhead of the church? It reads, "The Corporation for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." This is not simply a title. It has become a theme which runs throughout the church. It has become a substance of the church. It is there in the look and courage for leaders, i.e. the business suit. It is there in how we spread the gospel, sales meetings with quotas and graphs. It's there in advertising on TV and radio with come-on audio cassettes, one such with our own version of the Marlboro Man, Mormon Marlboro Man. It's there in marketing studies. It's there in home teaching. I can't tell you the number of talks I've sat in where it begins, "Brethren, statistics are not important, but..." And we spend the whole rest of the time talking about statistics. It is there whenever we look across the valley and see the church headquarters, which dwarfs the temple next door. It could be any office building in any corporation. I do not think that this is totally by design, but we draw much of our leadership vigils who have been trained and who were or are successful in the business world. That is corporate America. This comes from our decision not to be an authentic counterculture, as are the Amish, who hold themselves apart. These leaders bring their business practices, which have been successful in the world, into the church and try to adapt them into programs to achieve the goals of the church. What has developed is the image of the church leader wearing a business suit, briefcase in hand, rushing from one meeting to another, and never at home. Remember, I said a moment ago, the corporation has probably done as much or more than anything else to undermine the importance of the family in America. So here is a great irony. Men trained by corporations, shaped by corporations, and who structure their time like any corporate executive stand before us and tell us that the family is the most important unit on earth. I believe what makes women angry is that it all sounds vaguely like a lie. Many women must be left asking themselves if these leaders can possibly believe very deeply in what they are preaching when those leaders' lives hardly reflect the importance they are placing on home and family. It seems at times that women have been assigned to the home so that priesthood leaders can go on to even more pressing business. Thus, the woman is left alone at home with children who are being constantly wooed away by movies, videos, amusements, and other products of all and sundry sorts. She becomes a conduit to their pleasure. She is left in a home which has been sapped of a good deal of its vitality, energy, and importance. She ceases to be a mother. She must feel invisible. Now, I take some issue, actually, with the solutions that Bettina suggested. And I don't know how much time I have to go into that type of thing. I actually don't. I have 2 minutes to resolve this for the church. My wife asked me yesterday, "Are you going to resolve this?" having said these things, which sound fairly critical, I guess I'll take these 2 minutes to say that I think, actually, that the answer is there in embryo inside the gospel. The last 2 years I've spent studying the New Testament, the Book of Mormon, and the Doctrine and Covenants in particular. And my own sense is that it is there. That even those revelations taken out of historical context, and I think they have to be taken out of historical context if you want to have some sense of truth about them, not relative truth, but absolute truth, I think that the solution is there. The bishop of our ward and I were talking one day. He's a Samoan, which brings a kind of an interesting slant on things. But he said, when the original revelations were given to us through Joseph Smith, like the children of Israel coming out of Egypt, we turned them down. I think it is in that particular fact that we were offered certain covenants at the time of the Restoration, and we turned those covenants down for a lesser law, and now a lesser law, and I think we're ready to choose even a lesser law than that. I think these problems now have begun to seep into the church, the things that we're discussing today. Anyway, that's all I'll say.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes for questions. Raise your hands and direct them by name to whichever one you'd like to talk to. Right here, John.
Where Martin says the answer is there, but he didn't give us the answer.
That's the subject of a whole other session, you know, I'm afraid. But, you know, one thing, I'll read this one section, a piece from the 121st section, which is one of my favorite things. No power influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness, meekness, and by love unfeigned. I think the corporation is a hierarchical organization by its nature. There has to be a top and a bottom. But I believe, had we moved ahead and accepted the original covenants that were offered us, we would have moved in a direction we can't even much imagine, and we would get some glimpse of it. But I believe ultimately the whole idea of priesthood is, I don't want to say horizontal, but in a sense it's horizontal, but the concept of oneness that we toy with occasionally is the possibility. And yet I don't think we'll ever achieve that oneness, you know, going in the direction that we're going.
You talked about choosing a lesser law and then a lesser law, and now we're choosing another lesser law. Could you
elaborate on that? Yeah, I knew if I threw that in, I'd get in trouble here. For one thing, the Doctrine and Covenants is a fairly strongly stated book on our our responsibility to the poor and our position in the world temporally. It says, in fact, one of the quotes is that no great outpouring of the Spirit can come without temporal equality, and the law of consecration was given to us to achieve that. We turned it down. We walked away from it. History of the early church is pretty clear that people kept things back. That's one thing that we've stepped away from. We can go on down through the line, but the particular law that I'm talking about right now is that we're accepting a kind of corporate law. In essence, we've almost invited the beast into our home, and to keep the church running, to keep our statistics up, keep people coming, get the work done. And I appreciate, you know, the difficulty of that, the idea that we've got a certain amount of work that has to be accomplished. And yet, it seems to me, to accomplish that, we're moving away, even further away from the original covenant. Does that clear that up a little? Okay.
Okay, the lady back in the back. Yeah.
I want you to address responsibility upon something outside of yourself.
Yeah, my responsibility is personal. I don't have any. I haven't been given anything, power to speak for the church. However, within my own home and my own situation, I have a personal responsibility, and that's the only one I really can accept. If you're right to some extent, However, our emphasis in our home is to try and reestablish as best we can the covenants that we believe will lead somewhere positive and creative. And those were the ones I feel that were originally revealed, that came through Joseph Smith. Well, I spend my life skirting questions, especially hard ones.
Repeat what she said in the mic so that
can you. Okay, she. Well, that's fine. The question was that I skirted the issue and didn't address her talk, The Invisible Woman. See, what I... under patriarchy, right. But our patriarchy has always taken more of its cue from the world than anywhere else. It's taken its lead from the world and not... Pardon? No, see, you're talking about something that, on the one hand, that is a worldly concept. We take the concepts of God and we change them into our own image. That's all I'm saying. In some sense, see, I don't think we'll ever resolve this question going in the direction we're headed, because I think ultimately that we're going to find there's a contradiction.
Okay, we don't have any more time right now. This is a passionate topic that will occupy much of our time for a long time, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for coming, and enjoy the day.